hope, Chris, if you're listening, you're having fun in Europe, honey, with Miss Sayana.
Yes.
And
she's been working hard.
If you're still listening, come to Dacha on Wednesday again. Yeah. We will see you there, hopefully. Uh-huh.
And see you next Monday here at 6 p.m. also.
Yes.
CKUT. Yes.
90.3 FM.
For more ADHD and self-reflective work.
But, never mind.
Go ahead.
I was gonna say we'll be more prepared next week, but I'm not really a part.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio, feminist waves brought to you by CKUT and the Center for Gender Advocacy.
The Dragon Root Media Collective aims to bring you feminist content that challenges interlocking systems of oppression and makes space for voices systemically silenced. Dragonroot understands media as being inherently political and emphasizes media skill sharing as a form of resistance.
We meet every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the Center for Gender Advocacy and welcome anyone interested in learning or producing feminist media to join. No skills required.
Welcome to Dragonroot Radio. Today we are bringing you an archive from the vault. Welcome to Dragon Root Radio. On today's show, we spoke with Hannah Harris-Sutro and Marika Hendricks on their event, Quarantine Somatic for Queers. We spoke about the event itself, embodied healing, and activism.
So my name is Hannah, and I'm a somatics practitioner and facilitator who has been doing support work in Montreal's mostly queer communities since I first moved here in 2006. And at this point, for the past about 5 years, my work has been mostly working with one-on-one clients and groups to do change and transformation and healing work through the body, particularly trauma healing work, both shock trauma, individuals' developmental trauma, and then, of course, also the traumas of systemic oppression that are part of all of our trauma landscapes, just as much as our personal and individual experiences are, and not really extricable from each other. And that perspective is kind of the foundation of the way that I do my somatic work. Yeah. There's probably like more that I could say about, you know, lineages and teachers and all of that kind of stuff, but maybe I'll leave that for a little bit later and see where we're going with this. And let Marika just introduce herself to start with.
My name's Marika, and I am a somatics practitioner, a somatic therapist, and I also work with people one-on-one and in groups. And I came to this work through activism, through social justice work in communities, mostly in Toronto, where I was involved in a lot of anti-colonial migrant justice and Indigenous solidarity organizing, and kind of through the work of organizing in those spaces, getting really curious about how trauma is shaping and informing our movements for liberation. And that kind of brought me to learning about politicized somatics through the lineage, one of the lineages that I've trained in that is called generative somatics. And so I became kind of really interested in the intersections of embodied healing and social justice work. And that kind of shaped a path for me in terms of developing a practice and going to school to become a therapist. And I also work primarily with queer and trans people in my practice, and I work with a lot of folks who are involved in social movement work and really similarly feel really compelled to bringing the work of embodiment and nervous system education and embodying our values and our politics into social movement spaces. And so that looks like individual work and also group work and kind of the spectrum of working from interpersonal and developmental trauma to the ways in which that connects to collective and systemic and intergenerational trauma.
So for our listeners who aren't familiar with somatics or somatic practice, can you describe a little bit about what that is and means, and maybe some of the lineages?
So I guess I usually say that somatics is an embodied methodology of change that treats the body as a whole that is more than the sum of its parts. The body as, you know, as opposed to kind of a Western medical view of the body where we break it down into all these little parts and try to really like isolate things and diagnose and fix different little things. Somatics is going to want to treat the body as a whole organism that is embedded within an interdependent context of life. So when we're doing somatic work, we're listening for the stories of the body in addition to the spoken stories that most of us are a little bit more familiar with. We want to give those stories that show up in sensation and in gesture and in like texture or image or emotion as much space as we do the more cognitive and verbal stories that we have about ourselves. Because when we are actually present in our bodies, that is the way that we have, that is the way that we can actually change how we understand ourselves and how we act. There's kind of a limit to what we can do only working with how we think about ourselves. So for me, the essential parts are really focusing on the body as the primary site of healing and change, and understanding that body is always embedded within interdependent webs of connection with other life, both other humans and non-human life, including plants and animals, the land itself, the waters around us, ancestors or other non-human beings or entities. And probably Marika's definition of somatics would be like both similar and different. And then my own lineages of somatic work are somatic experiencing. I'm a somatic experiencing practitioner, biodynamic craniosacral work, of which I'm a student, and also generative somatics, although my relationship with generative somatics is mostly through my mentor, Banisar, not through training directly with them. But since she is my main teacher, it's a very foundational piece of the way that I work.
Yeah. So my definition would be very similar to Hannah's, which mean we work together. So there are lots of synchronicities and a lot of alignment in our work. And I think, like, for me, there's such a kind of moment happening with somatic work and embodied work right now. And it feels really important to me to, like, continue to ground that in a, like, in a politicized and cultural context. And so when we say, like, the body and the mind, to me, I think the mind is part of the body. And so to me, somatics is about widening our perspective or our lens to include the whole of our experience. And that, for me, that feels very political, because being cut off from our bodies, being cut off from trusting our bodies as sources of knowledge and wisdom and connection, is a deeply white supremacist colonial project that we are all traumatized by, that we carry the trauma of in our bodies. And so when we bring the body into conversation and we, like, listen to the stories of our bodies, like Hannah talked about, we are bringing things back into relationship that are inherently always connected. And so that feels inherently political to me. And I think that another piece that feels really sort of central for me and how I think of somatic work is really in terms of how it intersects with like social change work, and this idea of, if we only understand systems and structures in our minds, we're not always necessarily acting in alignment with, like, our values and integrity. So we might have, like, an idea or a concept that something is bad or problematic, but if we embody, you know, if there's an embodied, like, pattern or behavior that is, like, survival based, that will like hijack or short circuit our, like, an analysis and intellectual understanding, like, every time, because that's just how bodies work. They're wired to help us survive. So to me, it's like there's an impulse that's also just like, how are we bringing ourselves into alignment with what we care about and with what we want to show up for? Like, are we actually doing the thing? And having spent lots of time in spaces where there's a lot of talk and not a lot of, and, like, actually, like, the trauma of being, like, talking about one thing but then not embodying it, embodying sometimes something very different, I think, again, it's, like, about bringing those things back into, bringing our perspective to the whole of that experience. And my lineages are quite similar. I came to somatic work through generative somatics and have worked with a practitioner and with teachers in that lineage since 2013. And then I also am a student of biodynamic craniosacral therapy and I'm really sort of like influenced by somatic experiencing through relationships with practitioners that I have who are trained in that lineage and then also through the lineage of cultural somatics through Resmaa Menakem's work as well.
You mentioned politicizing somatics. Can you talk a bit about how these practices, how you take it embodied practice, what's the impact kind of externally in terms of social change and action?
I would place a lot of that in kind of what Mariko was speaking about like the way that somatic work allows us to become more coherent, allows us to become better at really feeling into how is it to behave in a way that is aligned with these beliefs and ethics that are important to me. You know, humans are a very unique species in that we do have this like big old brain that like thinks about all this stuff and creates these structures of like what is good and what is bad and how do I want to be in the world. And like Marika said, that actually isn't sufficient to allow us to fully embody that belief. So what we see when we have more bodies that are awake to more of the truth of how it is to be me or how it is to be you, and who are more skillful at understanding what's going on inside our bodies, when we're feeling safe, when we're feeling unsafe, we're able to build much more resilient relationships at every level. We're able to build more resilient relationship with ourselves, with our friends, with our lovers, our partners, our chosen family, our blood family. We're able also to build more resilient relationships with people who we're not actually friendly with, to have more resilience to conflict or to critique or to disagreement than we might otherwise. And I think especially when we're talking about white supremacy, which a lot of us are talking about even more than we used to be talking about it in this moment, you know, one of the things that I hear the most often about whiteness is how unreliable white folks are, because there's such a deep racial shame, I think, around whiteness that, you know, I think, so the thing about shame is that when we're deep in a place of shame, you can't really go into appropriate accountability. You're either going to be under accountable or over accountable, which means either white folks are being in denial about the existence of racism or that we ourselves are racist and can be racist, or we're kind of collapsing and being like, okay, let me try to do everything, or let me like rescue everyone. Neither of those is actually a sustainable way to engage in anti-racism in a white body. We actually need to be much more stable, much more coherent with our ups and our downs, and when we're feeling like we're leaning in too close and when we're kind of like pushing ourselves away, and practice with that in a way that allows us to find the right distance and our right size to make sustainable relationships, where when we do that, when our relationships are reliable and sustainable, they also then deepen and become more impactful and more able to hold bigger change, because we've had more of that, like, ooh, I kind of fucked it up there, and then I was able to like dial it back and like repair, as opposed to like, ooh, I kind of fucked it up, and then I, you know, completely exploded and did more damage, or I just like collapsed and like overcommitted to stuff I couldn't actually do to repair and then cause more harm. So that's like one of the small examples of how when we do our own personal embodied healing work, it really ripples out in pretty like constantly increasing and multiplying ways.
I think the only other thing I would add to that is the ways in which with folks that I work with, who are organizers, one of the things that I find often is like a really like pivotal turning point for people is the ways in which like practicing embodiment and centering and some of those embodied skills that Hannah was just talking about, when we're able to kind of come back to that like center place, that like we can find more possibility. And so that's such an important part of political work, is like having, you know, that our strategy and vision for liberation can come from like an expansive set of possibilities. And when we're operating from a place of trauma, we're often operating within like dichotomies and binaries. And this is, I think, also like a really big part of somatic practice as queer people, is like the ways in which we are already living outside of those like boxes and dynamics and norms, and that that is an embodied skill, and that we have so much wisdom already in like being in bodies as queer people. And so, yeah, with folks that I work with who can so often feel really like rigid and stuck in like these kinds of like the structures that we live in, there's a way in which like we don't have to have all the answers, we don't have to like have all of the like boxes ticked, but like being able to surrender to like unknowing can often can offer like new senses of possibility for what can emerge. And that can be so liberating for people who feel really stuck inside of, it's like we need to acknowledge the structures that exist because they're very real and have very real impacts on our bodies and on different bodies in different ways. And there has to be like a vision for like liberatory potential and possibility. Like I think we're seeing such like powerful examples of that right now. Like and embodied practice can really like open up and widen the range of possibility.
So we originally got in touch about your workshop, Quarantined Somatics for Queers. Can you tell us a bit about this workshop and why it was important to give at this time?
Yeah, so it's actually funny thinking about the like genesis of that space, because when I think back on it, it was like we had one conversation and we were just like, are we doing this? We need to do this. This is how we're going to do it. We're going to do it. Okay. And it was like, it didn't feel like urgency. It felt like really purposeful and really like prepared and responsive. And I think that we were reflecting afterwards on how we were really prepared for that moment, and that this is part of what somatic practice gives us, is that we were like able to kind of show up and offer something pretty quickly. So Quarantine Somatics for Queers came together within the first few weeks of the quarantine, and was really like an offering where we were sort of thinking, okay, we're still able to work, which a lot of people are not. There is like risk of isolation and disconnection on like a vast scale right now. And we really want people to still have practices and spaces to connect through this really difficult time. And we want to offer this like place to share practices, to be in community, especially with other queer people, knowing how as folks are more isolated, they might also be, or often are more isolated from queer community. And also recognizing that there is like a history of pandemic in queer communities, and that we already have a lot of knowledge about how to care for each other. And so we really like, we felt like it wasn't perfect and we didn't know exactly what would happen, but like we wanted to make that offer. And we decided to do it as like a fundraiser. So half of the proceeds, the first round went to the People's Healing Fund. And then the second one went to Hoodstock Montreal in Montreal. And it just felt really like really clear and precise that that was the offering that we wanted to make, and that it was a structure that allowed us to offer support for folks to gather and also to redirect resources directly back to majority BIPOC community services, projects, and offerings.
I think like one of the things that I want to really highlight about that process is both that thing that Marika was saying about how it didn't feel urgent. It just felt like we were extremely prepared to be very present, and then to just pivot and be like, we see a very clear need. This is what we can offer to meet that need. So just the ease of that, and the difference in acting in that way from kind of the like overwhelm and panic that I think is more what I was more familiar to acting from in other stages of my life. So that piece, just kind of like feeling a lot more grounded, even in a circumstance where like a lot of panic was coming up, and like, you know, both of us in our own ways had like fear and trauma stuff like flare up, and you know, whatever, like I think many people did. This global collective trauma has been really, really activating around a lot of people's like core wounds and any traumas that are about attachment and relationship, because it's impacting so severely our abilities to access those things. But then also this kind of space that I sometimes talk about is like a win-win-win, which is like sometimes I think not looked at that much in really urgent activist-y cultures, because we don't tend to put a lot of attention on pleasure or on like how is it that someone is doing solidarity work for their own liberation or because it's genuinely like exciting for them, as opposed to because they need to rescue someone or because it's like the right thing to do and they're a bad person if they don't do it, which we have, you know, learned and seen over and over are not very sustainable motivations for being engaged in solidarity work. So this was this thing where, you know, like Marika said, we had no idea what would happen. It was very much an experiment, although rooted in our experiences so far. And then what actually happened was that it was shockingly successful very quickly. Like we put up the first announcement, we had decided to make it a fundraiser. We decided that we would give actually 50% of the cut, which was like a bigger cut than I've often redirected in a circumstance where it's not entirely a fundraiser. And we were like, yeah, we might not make any money on that and it's fine. And also it was my first time in probably like almost 10 years offering something that was like purely pay what you can, because what I had learned from many previous experiences doing pay what you can is that white folks and wealthy folks still give you the change out of their pocket. And it's not actually a sustainable model. So I was very pleasantly surprised when we launched this thing and it actually sold out in like 24 hours. And people did pay a huge range. We've had it at every time that we've run this thing, we've had people register at $0. And we've also had people register on the high end of the spectrum and sometimes had people actually pay higher than the spectrum that we suggested. Yeah. So just like seeing that unfold so quickly was like a very immediate validation of like the offering that we made. It showed us that it was correctly structured, that it was meeting the needs of what people were looking for at that point in time. And it was extremely, extremely exciting to have this structure come in where we were able to redirect a really significant chunk of money that was more than either of us individually made on doing the work, but that the cut that we took home still felt like an appropriate, respectful amount to get paid for the skilled work that we're doing. And as femme people, we're both very, very accustomed to the work that we do being constantly invisible and or taken for granted and or demanded or extracted without actually being recognized or compensated. So it just felt very right on multiple levels to be redirecting those funds as mutual aid towards BIPOC-led healing efforts, but also to still be nourished instead of to be doing that shame thing of collapsing and then overextending and being like, you know, I'm just going to like throw myself into this and give it all away. And then I'm going to burn out a month in or 2 months in, because that's not actually sustainable for my nourishment to just like, you know, throw myself into it and not have any recognition or compensation at all. And I feel like that doesn't get talked about that much because it's like this very complicated, sometimes I call it the Venn diagram of like all the work white folks should do should be anti-racist, contradicted with the reality that like white folks shouldn't be paid for doing anti-racism work as such. So Marika and I talk a lot about existing in that weird, like no hard and fast right answers, but a lot of possibilities and a lot of ways to fuck it up. So like, how do we figure out how to exist in that contradiction space of like, everything we do should be by an anti-racist ethic, and for our own longings and our own liberation must be from an anti-racist ethic, because investment in whiteness is not liberatory for white people either. But then also like, not making all of our work anti-racism work or making a name for ourselves or like a career out of like, quote unquote, being anti-racist, because that also would be a super weird thing to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, decentering ourselves, but continuing to like offer the skills and resources that we have in like a right-sized way, which I think we've talked about in relation to this space a lot. And in terms of some of the impacts, like folks have come repeatedly to like several of the groups and have shared the practices that they've learned in the space, they've taken with them and have shared with others or have brought to other spaces. So we tried to make it really accessible, really adaptable. And we do like explain why we're doing things, but the emphasis is on being together in embodied ways. So, you know, there's like no shortage of like podcasts and books and people doing like Instagram lives about like nervous system, like technology. And we were really like, this is not what that is. This is about actually being together in embodied practice. And so, yeah, we like shared practice that was around connection with each other, practice around grounding and containment in our bodies, and practices around drawing on like queer community and queer ancestry as sources of support and resilience. And we had folks attending like from all over the world. Folks came from Australia, some folks in Europe and Germany, people came from across the states, and folks who are doing like frontline responding work, like folks who were like just coming from or about to go to demos, other practitioners who've been doing embodied work for a long time, and also people who are totally new to somatics, just trying it for the first time. And what was really beautiful about this space was that we were offering a container, but we were not in the position of like expert therapists or something. We were just like, the real nourishment is the container and the practice that we do together. And so folks were really able to like resource from each other, and we were really resourced as well. And it's like, that speaks to that same kind of mutual investment piece that Hannah talked about, is it's like, we offered this from a place of like, we are mutually invested in this work, and we are resourced by it, as well as, you know, it's something that we offer for others, but it's also something that we are resourced by. And that feels like a sustainable model, like that could go on for a long time. So
one of my favorite teachers and collaborators, and Kali Hashiki, says, if both people aren't healing, nobody's healing. And I think that's a really radical thing to say about healing work, because that's very much not the model of Western psychotherapy or social work, in which you're supposed to kind of just be this like total blank slate, like, you know, mirror and or intervention worker who's not necessarily showing up in your wholeness, not really allowed to like make much personal disclosure. And definitely the process is not supposed to be like healing for you as the practitioner in any way. And of course, this doesn't mean that, like, you know, when I'm doing trauma therapy with my clients, it becomes about like my trauma or about like what I need that day for my ongoing healing trajectory, but just that my own presence in that space, like the way that I'm doing my work, needs to be happening in a way that is actually like good for me, that's not damaging to me, that doesn't force me to be outside of my body or outside of my ethics or outside of my values. And outside of my, you know, commitments to people and to movements that are important to me for all of our collective liberation. Yeah. Oh, and the other thing I wanted to say is we really, really believe in repetition of practice as a mode for change. So although we ran this space, I think we've run it 8 times now. We did 4 rounds for our first cycle funding the People's Healing Fund, and then 4 rounds for our second cycle funding Woodstock. And we didn't change our agenda at all. We did pretty much the same practices all of those 8 weeks. Of course, it shows up in slightly different ways week to week. The specific holds that we worked with and the self-touch piece of it were different every week. We would share a text at the end that was like a queer elder ancestor's wisdom as a way to kind of like take that with us into the in-between weeks, and that would be different every time. But the practices were the same. And I think that also was a very intentional choice that we made to kind of counter the constant urgency, and also the very capitalist value of everything needing to be new all the time and needing to be constantly acquiring new skills, new practices, new knowledges. And it's like, that's not actually how change happens, though. Like, if you want your somatic shape to change, you have to practice the same shit over and over and over again. so many of my teachers say this thing, like, what you practice is what you become, because it's true. Like, we can't just think about it infinitely, but never practice what it is that we want to embody. And so, you know, sometimes I tell my clients that, like, the work of trauma healing can feel very tedious, because essentially all we're doing is noticing what's happening and then trying to support our bodies to find more safety and resilience over and over and over and over and over and over. But that is actually how the change happens. And so we were really trying to embody that value of cyclical time and of, like, repetition is actually not wasteful. It's actually essential. And the more we repeat it, the more the value of it grows in the way that we structured the space.
That's so interesting. I only booked in the event about 30 minutes, so I only have a couple more questions if you have the time. Okay, so I guess we touched on this a little bit already, but you mentioned how just having that container and community holding that space is really important right now. Can you speak a bit more to that importance in COVID and quarantine especially?
So working one-on-one with people and then in a group, like, you kind of get to see these, like, different perspectives on, like, trends in terms of the kind of, like, collective body from week to week during a pandemic. And I've often joked, it's like, this week people are doing well, last week it was really hard. Like, there seems to be, like, often kind of like a synchronicity or something. But one of the things that has been, like, that I've, at the beginning of the pandemic, was watching as a practitioner, that was so difficult, was just, like, seeing my clients and people that I worked with, and then also just people in my life, like, really just kind of, like, drop into this sort of shutdown place around isolation. And this dichotomy of, like, in order to, like, be good and do the right thing and protect other people, I need to, like, distance myself from, like, these core needs of connection. And there's so much that we can say about that in terms of, like, what that activates and brings up and in our bodies and in ourselves. But it was, like, watching people kind of, like, drop into this, like, lower, you know, register of, like, more collapse, more depression, more hopelessness, numbness. And so to me, it was like, I felt like I was just, like, telling everyone, like, you got to find groups, you got to gather, like, you can still feel your body connected to another body through the screen. We can, our bodies will collaborate with us to feel connection. So I think that, like, that's a little bit different now as, like, the weather has changed and folks have a bit more space and have a bit more understanding of, like, how we can be together. But the reality is that we still can't touch each other. We're still, like, we're at 4 months of, like, mostly knowing that other closeness to other bodies is dangerous. And, like, that's a very, like, that's a real thing. Like, and at the same time, there's a side effect of that, which is that we actually need connection to survive. And when we're isolated, our nervous systems perceive that as danger. And so go into a threat response. So it was like, it felt like first aid. Like, it was just like nervous system first aid. Like, how can we just keep dosing connection and co-regulation as much as possible? And really, like, learning how possible that was through the screen and through a virtual context. But there are lots of things that were important about it, but I think that felt like the most, like, if we're gonna talk about anything being urgent, like, that was where I felt some urgency for sure.
Yeah, for sure. I think as trauma therapists, and specifically as trauma therapists who are politicized and therefore very, very rooted in what is happening in the collective body, how is this collective trauma impacting the collective body? I think we were both just very attuned to the major risks of a pandemic in which connection is dangerous, but like Marika said, human bodies are interdependent. We're born interdependent, we die interdependent. Interdependence is not optional. So quite genuinely when we're losing connection, our bodies do go into a state of danger and threat. So it was both definitely the first aid for these nervous systems and for our collective nervous system, but then also kind of an ongoing hoped for preventative medicine. How can we kind of like support all of these people coming into this space together in sort of like building the resilience so that maybe some of this huge collective trauma doesn't impact us as intensely or is a little bit more like softened, or that we have a little bit more resilience to bring into living through this so that it does not destroy us as much as it might have otherwise. And like Marika mentioned earlier, really wanting to lean into both the reality that queer people might be feeling especially scared at this time, because although we don't talk about it that much anymore, like we did lose most of an entire generation of our people. And it wasn't that long ago. Most of us who are alive now were alive during the AIDS pandemic. So both that added layer of collective trauma coming up in a pandemic situation, but also the ancestral wisdom of like, you know, the AIDS pandemic happened and queer people invented safer sex and invented sex ed. Like we did that. That is our cultural legacy. And so we get to look at that innovation and be like, holy shit. Like, you know, we had people out in the catacombs in San Francisco putting on like up to the shoulder, like the kind of vet gloves that's used when they're gonna like help a cow give birth to like continue anal fisting. Like that is a brilliant queer collective technology of figuring out how to still have connection and pleasure even in a situation of horrific danger. And I know that because Gail Rubin documented it and wrote about it in her writing. She's a really important queer elder for me. So we also wanted to like offer that as well, both the acknowledgement of the potentially increased collective trauma and this reality that wherever there's trauma, there's always healing and always resilience that shows up alongside that. So how can we also tap into that?
What are some upcoming workshops, events that you're having, and where can people find?
So we are on a summer pause from the group and wanted to take some time to kind of reflect and regroup and tend to this offering. And so we've put together a survey that we're sending out to folks who've attended past groups to get some feedback and get a feel for how people are using the practices, if they are continuing to find them useful. And our hope is that that will inform an ongoing, like a return of the space, maybe with some modifications in the fall, as a regular pay what you can drop in somatic practice space that's like super accessible on a wide ranging sliding scale that would also be by donation. So really like sticking with that model. There will be like more news about that to come, and both of us will post that on our Instagrams, which I guess we can share at the end of this. I'm going to be launching a group in the fall that will be by registration to for folks who want to like deepen into an embodied practice in a more consistent way. And then really we both try and like offer, there's so much happening right now in terms of this work, and one of the things I've been like working with a lot this summer is that question of like showing up right-sized and not overextending or underextending, and the call to really like center and like uplift the voices and work of BIPOC practitioners, especially Black practitioners right now. And so I'm also just like really wanting to do that. And so really like highlighting the work of like La Mirad Owens, who just released a book called Love and Rage that is like a really beautiful offering in this moment, and Makali Hashiki, who is another person who Hannah mentioned, who's been doing, I don't know if they're weekly or bi-weekly, but regular somatic practice spaces for QT BIPOC. And she's on Instagram at Fierce Passions. And then other folks in our communities who we're connected to, who we like really try to repost and like really direct folks towards their work as well. So
Yeah, similar kind of zone, taking a pause with quarantine somatics careers to kind of do a little bit of reevaluation and relaunch it as like a not only for quarantine, more sustainable ongoing practice space, since we've been seeing the need for that and the ripple effects of people having access to that space. This thing that Marika is thinking about like being right size, we've been talking a little bit about potentially offering at some point in the future, an offering around that alongside an offering that I've had of the past few years, which is a skill shop around working with shame, because that I find is both deeply embedded in so much of queer somatic shapes due to constantly being shamed and being sexualized in a shameful way because we live in colonial Puritan culture. But then also that being one of the things that really trips people up around finding how to engage in terms of solidarity work or activism. So just wanting to really put those skills out there as much as possible and like share that knowledge as much as possible, because shame also is a relational wound. So the more we do our individual healing work around shame, the more that ripples out into the collective. And then I also have been running an online queer somatic practice space that has been a closed group that meets almost every week for almost 2 years now. That's called Moonwork. And the intention of that was very similar to Quarantine Somatics for Queers, but a little bit different in that not only is it intended to be like, let's practically gather on a regular basis to actually do our somatic practices together, but also kind of an experiment in creating a collective culture that's like body-based and liberation-based. And how does it look when we come together in a way that like we get to know each other nervous system first, we get to know each other body first. And when we work together in a long container, people build different kinds of intimacies and get to reach different like depths in practice. So it's been extremely exciting and satisfying to see how people's relationships both to somatic practice and to like being in the world, being in relationship with what is alive other than humans, has really changed through that space and through participation in that space and what they've offered each other. So that's called Moonwork. And I guess we can go into the like where you find us on the internet.
Yeah. Where can we find you online?
Yeah, so my website is bodywitch.com and my Instagram is bodywitchery. Those are probably the two easiest and like most frequent places that I will put information about what I'm doing. And Quarantine Somatics for Queers, we mostly were promoting just through Instagram. So that would be the place to look for that. And I'll let Marika share her internet contact places.
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at wildbodysomatics. And my website is my name, marikaheinrichs.com. And yeah, those are I have a newsletter that you can sign up for through my website or through my Instagram. And I'm not taking on more individual clients right now, but if you're interested in like group offerings or in staying connected, then those are good places to get connected.
Well, thank you both so much for taking the time. Thank you.
write songs through the day, be alone with my thoughts. Spend time with the ones that I've always adored. They say, don't go out, don't get lost in the dark.
That was our interview with Hannah Harris-Sutro and Marika Hendricks on their event, Quarantine Somatics for Queers. We put together a collection of interviews from Montreal zinesters to discuss feminist implications and role that zines play. For many people, zines act as a medium of creativity, of self-discovery, and of activism. We have a couple guests on today's show to give you a better idea of what these DIY independent publications are all about.
Thanks.
First off, I guess it'd be useful to give listeners a bit of a definition of zines. So how would you define zines to someone who's not familiar with them?
I guess the easiest way to define zines is generally as small, independently produced publications. They usually have pretty low production values. Lots of zines are made so that they can be easily photocopied. You can see a variety of zines from things that are made from really tiny publications that are basically done with one sheet of paper that's been folded up, to zines that are multi-page. Some run in a series, some are one-offs. Some are done in a cut-and-paste style, which involves cutting up pieces of paper, gluing them to a page, and then photocopying that for layout. Other people make zines on a computer. And early zine culture was mainly, you know, all print and then distributed that way. And now there are zines that are hybrids of online and print publications together. And some people make what they call e-zines, which are basically online zines that basically sort of have some of the characteristics of what a print zine would look like, except that it's online.
Right. And what kind of content do zines cover? Are there different kinds of zines?
Zines cover a whole range of topics and issues. Basically, anything you can think of, there's probably a zine about it. But there's sort of three major categories that I would think of when I think of how you might classify zines. The first one would be personal zines or perzines. So zines that are made from like a first person perspective, and it's basically that person talking about maybe an experience or a memory that they have, or it can just be random collections of thoughts, things that they like. There are political zines, so zines that are made around a particular topic, a political issue to raise awareness or educate people. And then there's, what's the last one I would talk about? Maybe fanzines that are made, you know, to show sort of a person's devotion to a particular band or a particular music scene, or some aspect of media culture that that person's really into. There was a really famous zine at one point called Crap Hound that I would think of as a fanzine, which was basically this person's about this person's sort of obsession with junk, and he would sort of include like vintage advertisements and stuff and talk about things that he was collecting.
And how would you describe the audience that zines cater to in terms of who receives zines, who makes zines?
One of the things that I really like about zines is that they can be really, really random in terms of how people find them and access them. You might find a zine slipped into your backpack secretly, or you might find one in a subway. So anyone can find zines, but zines generally emerged out of punk culture in the late 80s and early 1990s. And so they tend to have a history of being associated with underground culture. And I would say that that's still where you find a lot of zines being made and being read.
And how do you say how zines are relevant to feminism?
I think that zines are particularly relevant to feminism in two ways. For one thing, they're really associated with Riot Girl, which was a feminist punk subculture that was really prominent in the early and mid-1990s, and that continues to exist today in different versions and in different locations. So zines are associated with that particular feminist punk subculture. But also, I would say more broadly, when you're looking at cultural production, the way that girls and women tend to be talked about in relation to media is as consumers. And zine culture is really about women and girls producing their own media. And so that's something that makes zines really attractive to me as a feminist scholar, because it's an instance where you see girls and women showing a lot of agency and putting their voices out there. And I think zines are a really accessible and easy way for folks to do that.
And how do zines align with third wave feminism in particular?
Well, as I said, there's kind of two main ways. One is that they're associated with a particular generation, and they became really prominent in the early 1990s, which is also the time that scholars say we see an emergence of a third wave. When we're thinking about third wave feminism, it's often characterized as having this sort of turn towards looking at cultural production within it, sort of away from kind of institutional politics, like looking at sort of official modes of making change within institutions, and moving towards thinking about how media culture kind of influences the world, and influences how people think about sexism, racism, classism, and homophobia. But I would say that zines also kind of challenge the way we might think of the wave metaphor. If we look at zines within the history of feminist publishing, we can see that there's a really long history of feminists making their own media. And I would say that there are continuities between the zines that Riot Girls were producing, say, in the 1990s, the zines that feminists are producing now. There's continuities between that and the sort of independent publishing that feminists were doing in the 1960s and 1970s. They were starting their own presses. There's a really diverse range of like posters, brochures, pamphlets, magazines, lo-fi periodicals. You could look at the very first issue of Our Bodies, Ourselves, and it looks like a zine. And that was in 1970. And so I think there's this long history of feminist independent publishing, and I like to see zines as part of that history. And in that sense, it kind of challenges the wave metaphor in a way that I think is really useful, because I think, for one, it's more historically accurate. And also, I think that the wave metaphor tends to kind of produce this weird generational divide between feminists that I don't think is politically productive either.
And could you tell us a bit about how you first got involved with zines, or how you first discovered them?
Yeah, how I first discovered them. Well, I was a teenager once in the 90s, and I lived in a small town, and we didn't have a particularly vibrant zine culture there, or at least not one that I knew about. But I had a friend with an older sister who did make zines. So I had one or two of those, and I thought they were pretty amazing. But I didn't really know what they were. I just thought it was like a cool thing that my friend's older sister had produced. And then later on, when I was in university, I actually started a feminist radio show at my university. And someone said, "Oh, you should do something about zines and Riot Girl." And I thought, "Oh, I don't really know much about that." So I kind of I learned more about zines actually through doing radio. And then when it came time for me to do my dissertation, I really wanted to do work on stuff that I was interested in and reading anyway. And at the time, I was reading a lot of feminist magazines like Bust and Bitch. And those started as zine publications. So I started researching zines more through more mainstream feminist magazine culture. And that's when I got really into them. And that's also when I started making them a little bit as well.
And now you teach a course on feminist periodicals at McGill. Why did you think this class is important for women's studies students, or why did you choose to teach it?
Well, it's always really great when you can teach a class that's on stuff that you're actually researching. So this class was the sort of opportunity for me to kind of test run, like, I've done all this writing about zines and magazines, what would it be like to teach a class where I was talking about some of that work that I've done? So that's sort of my reason, my selfish reason for doing the class. But I guess also I think that there's things about zines that raise broader questions within feminism about the wave metaphor, as I've talked about earlier. But I think also some of the debates that you see coming up in zine culture around what is effective politically is a question that's really salient for feminism, and not just for feminism, but for other progressive social movements. So I think that is one of the main things that I want students to be thinking about in this course.
Great. Thank you so much for coming in.
Discuss. We're blinding.